Honors. Excuse me.
Good afternoon.
Tom Cowart and Charles McBeth for the appellants, Patrick and Lois Gallagher. This is briefly, it's an appeal from summary judgments granted in the court below on a legal malpractice case. And although there's a variety of interesting issues raised in the appeal, I'm really just going to focus on two of them here with my time. The first being the issue of the need for expert testimony to support the Gallagher's claims in response to the no evidence summary judgment motion. And then the second being the application of the statute of limitations as raised in Mr. Wilson's traditional motion for summary judgment. The underlying litigation arises out of probate litigation. Mr. Gallagher's mother died in 2003. He was named as the executor in her will. Her property was to pass in equal share to her two remaining sons, her only sons, her two children. And Mr. Gallagher hired Mr. Wilson to represent him in the estate of his mother's property. Now, he hired Mr. Wilson before the probate was started. So Mr. Wilson filed the probate action. And in the course of the probate action in 2003, on three separate occasions, Mr. Wilson advised Mr. Gallagher to sign under oath three different documents that listed the estate's property, the inventory twice, and the original inventory, an amended inventory, and then the closing document that listed the estate's property. In all three of those documents, he listed two pieces of real estate as being 100% essentially free and clear of the property of the estate. One of those pieces of property, which we refer to in the briefing as the Trinity Vista property, Mr. Gallagher claimed to own 100%, that he purchased it, but he titled it in his mother's name for purposes of medical care, as I understand it. Now, the record's not clear, it doesn't explain, and we're criticized for not explaining why he thought that was a good thing to do, but that doesn't matter, I think, in this context, because it's a summary judgment proceeding. Mr. Wilson didn't acknowledge Mr. Gallagher's claims to ownership of that Trinity Vista property in any of the estate closing documents, in any of the estate documents, the inventories, the amended inventory, or the closing document. Mr. Gallagher transferred that Trinity Vista property for himself to himself and to his wife. He just retitled it, essentially. He redeeded it. He deeded it as the executor out of the estate and to himself and to his wife, which was essentially just a paperwork transaction, since he claims he owned 100% of it anyway. His brother Garrett wasn't happy with the explanation that he owned that property, and so he later sued Mr. Gallagher, claiming that he was engaged in self-dealing by transferring estate property to himself without giving Garrett, if you will, referring to them by their first names now. Garrett is the brother, Pat. I should have referred to him the whole time as Pat or Patrick. That's my client, Mr. Gallagher. So Garrett claims that when Patrick transferred the property from, redeeded the property out of the estate and to himself, that he engaged in self-dealing. And ultimately, that litigation is settled. There's some other allegations of misconduct by Mr. Wilson in the course of the resolution of the lawsuit in between Garrett and Patrick and Lois. Mr. Wilson interfered with the transactions relating to the Trinity Vista property, interfered with the sale of the other piece of property, real estate, that actually was his mom's, and failed to respond appropriately to some discovery requests in the course of that litigation. So there's a variety of claims of malpractice that will come up as we go through this, but the original malpractice and the real significant malpractice is the failure to follow the plain provisions of the probate code in dealing with and listing the value, the debts, and the property of the Trinity of the estate action. Mr. Gallagher sued Mr. Wilson the lawsuit was filed June 1 of 2008. For legal malpractice. And Mr. Wilson ultimately files a no evidence motion for summary judgment. And in response to that, Mr. Gallagher presents his affidavit testimony that outlines the facts that I just outlined to you. It says, I relied on him when he insisted that I sign these documents under oath listing what was my property as estate property. That's how he responded to the no evidence summary judgment motion. And the question that comes up is, does Mr. Gallagher need expert testimony to show duty breach and causation in this context? And our argument in our briefs is no, he's not, and his argument below as well. No, he does not. And our view is that it's pretty plain that when you look at the case law that's developed, starting with this court's Delp opinion in 1997, that when you've got a situation where it's a clear violation and the client is really the one making the decision, it's the language that the Supreme Court used in the Alexander versus Turter case in 2004, is that when you've got the client as, quote, the key decision maker, and if a client has relied on his attorney's advice, and it's really the client's decision, the client makes the decision because it's what the attorney told him to do, and unfortunate consequences result, that you don't need an expert to come in and testify about in support of the legal malpractice claim. The cases that you look at in those kind of circumstances, they cite to the Delp case, which is an issue where you have a corporation that has three directors in it, and they're dividing up the corporations. They're parting ways. And a lawsuit arises in between the partners, and it gets settled. And in the course of that settlement, they sign off on certain documents, and the client says, the only reason I did is because the lawyer told me to do it. And the court says, basically, if the client didn't do it, it wouldn't have happened. That's what they mean when they say the client is the key decision maker. If the client didn't do it, it wouldn't have happened. The Fifth Circuit case, it's also cited by the Supreme Court, the Streber versus Hunter case, involved advice by a tax attorney about the tax consequences of a gift that could either be characterized as a gift in 1981 or could be characterized as a gift in 1985. And the lawyer advised the clients to treat it as a gift in 85 so that the giver bears the tax burden. Because if it had been a gift apparently in 1981, then the receiver would have bear the burden of the capital gains, which was the significant part of the gift. And so that's what they did, and they wound up getting sued by the IRS for not paying their taxes. And in that case there, the Fifth Circuit says the client didn't need expert support to prove their legal malpractice claim. Now, the Alexander case is not a case that specifically says you don't need expert support, because that's a case where the Supreme Court comes along and says you do need in this context. So as a way of contrasting what kind of cases you do and what kind of cases you don't, it's good to look at this Alexander case. In Alexander, it's a case where a complicated contract claim, I believe, is what the underlying claim was, but the basis of the claim of malpractice is that the client had hired a lawyer who was an experienced civil practitioner. And they said, I hired you because you know what you're doing in the courtroom. But when it came time to try the matter, it was actually tried in bankruptcy court as an adversarial matter, the lawyer sent an inexperienced associate to try the case. And as a result of that, allegedly as a result of the inexperience of the associate, certain evidence wasn't presented in the bankruptcy court, wound up ruling against the client. So they sued him for legal malpractice, saying if you had presented different evidence, if you'd done a better job preparing the case, then the result would have been different. And the Supreme Court says, well, the decision maker there is really the bankruptcy judge. That's not a situation like in Delp and Streber, where the client was the key decision maker. So the Supreme Court has drawn a line, to my mind, in between situations where you've got a third party who the lawyer is presenting to or trying to persuade to do something on behalf of their client, and then you've got other situations where the lawyer is simply telling the client, this is what the law is, this is what you're supposed to do, this is what you ought to do. And when it's the client who the lawyer is communicating with and who is making the decisions based off of what the lawyer has done, it seems to me that that's a line that says on the client's doing the thinking, the client's doing the signing, the client's making the decision, you don't need expert witnesses to come in and prove up your legal malpractice case. If you've got a situation like in trial, like in the Alexander case, where it's really a matter of judgment, what do you do? Which evidence do you put on? How do you cross-examine a witness? What objections do you make?
So, to make it easy for somebody like me to understand, essentially what you're saying is there's a difference between trial strategy and malpractice that's clear on its face.
I think that's right.
And if it's trial strategy, then there has to be some evidence to show why this is malpractice and not a failed trial strategy that could have worked.
I believe that's right, Your Honor, that if you're going to say that in the course of trying a case, you did something wrong, you have to bring in somebody who has the skill and experience to translate for the jury what it takes to succeed at trial. How do you go about presenting evidence at trial? How do you make judgment calls in the course of your presentations and your preparation that leads to success at trial? That's not something that everybody can pick up on.
So you're saying that then in a probate matter, an error in listing the assets of the estate is not a matter of trial strategy. It's just an error that it's apparent on the face.
Yes, ma'am.
And at least it raises then an issue of fact that should go to the trier of fact to determine who was responsible for this
error.
Mistake.
Yes,
on the determining the character of the property.
And especially given that the law is plain about what you're supposed to do. I mean, it's a statute. Section 250 of the probate code says list the estate's property. And so it's not a matter of coming in. I mean, in my experience, where I've seen this before is when you try to call a lawyer as an expert witness in other litigation to get them to testify about what the law is in front of the jury. And that's what judges do. Judges instruct the jury about what the law is. You don't bring in witnesses to say, let me read Section 250 of the probate code to you. And essentially, if you don't follow the black and white of the law, you don't have to bring in an expert to say they didn't follow the black and white of the law. I think that when you look at the cases that we've talked about in the brief, and the briefs are pretty thorough in their discussion of the cases that are out there, I believe, that as long as it's not a matter of judgment, essentially, you've got to have a lawyer explain judgment calls to a jury. But if it's essentially a bright line and the client is the one who's relying on the advice and the client is the one who's making the decision about what to do with that advice, you don't need expert testimony. So how does that apply to this case? Well, our client came in and filed the affidavit in response to the motion, no evidence motion for summary judgment. And when you look at that affidavit, you'll see that he outlined what the lawyer did wrong and how what the lawyer did wrong caused him to do to sign the documents that had the unfortunate consequences, and how those documents had, or what the unfortunate consequences were that flowed from those documents. He got sued. That's the first and the biggest one, really. If it weren't for, according to the documents, the affidavit, if it weren't for those inventories and the closing statements, he wouldn't have gotten sued. Because according to his testimony, that's what triggered the lawsuit, or that's what his brother was relying on when he filed his lawsuit. So our position, Your Honor, is that our client's testimony, the affidavit testimony, under the case law as it's developed, is sufficient to meet the burden of responding to the no evidence summary judgment motion, and that motion should have been denied. Now, the second issue is the statute of limitations issue, and that was raised in a traditional motion for summary judgment context. And the question there is, first, does the Hughes rule apply? Everybody knows the Hughes rule is the one that says that if there's malpractice in the prosecution or defense of a claim, then the statute of limitations on the malpractice claim is told until the litigation that flows from that malpractice is resolved. I kind of got my statement of the rule backwards there, I think. One of the questions is going to be, what's it mean to be a claim? And the reason that's at issue here is because in Apex Towing, the Supreme Court came along back behind itself in Hughes and said, we don't want you looking at the policy considerations that underlie our Hughes opinion. We simply want you to apply the rule. If it's a claim, if it's the prosecution or defense of a claim that results in litigation, statute of limitations is told. So the question becomes, what kind of cases fit that definition? So you got to look at what a claim means. And if you look at this basic group case out of Houston, which seems to be the most thorough and leading discussion of what it means to say it's a claim under Hughes, they say a claim is one in which the lawyer is handling a pre-existing right by the client. It doesn't matter if it's in civil litigation. It doesn't matter if it's in an administrative proceeding. It doesn't really matter if it's outside of the court system at the time that the malpractice occurs. If it involves a pre-existing right, then that's what the court means when it says a claim. So here what we've got is Mr. Gallagher had several pre-existing rights here. He had a pre-existing right to the house on Trinity Vista, according to his testimony. He says it was his. He says he owned it. He says he paid for it. He says he made all the payments on it. He owned that house, according to the testimony in the record before you now, which I think you've got to go with because it's a summary judgment case and there's nothing to controvert it here. Even if there was, it favors us, so it's a summary. That's a fact you have to take, I believe. He had a claim under the will to the estate property. And I'll leave it at that, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Wade Crosno, and I'm here along with my partner Sean Phelan on behalf of the appellee, Bruce Wilson. We've also brought with us today several summer associates at our from our Dallas office, and there's several of them, so that I won't try to introduce all of them to the court, but we're happy to have them here with us. And if any of my answers to your questions don't satisfy you, please feel free to call them up here and ask them to answer. I want to focus today on the expert testimony requirement, which is dispositive of this appeal. The general rule in Texas is that expert testimony is necessary to establish the breach and causation elements of legal malpractice and breach of fiduciary duty claims. There is a recognized exception to that rule. It's a narrow exception, and the exception is when the breach or causation issue is not within the common understanding of jurors and is not sufficiently obvious that it can be within their common understanding. In the Alexander case, the Texas Supreme Court addressed that exception and rejected the plaintiff's argument that this narrow exception applied to the question of whether errors in the preparation and trial of a case caused an adverse result.
Let me ask you a question here. Does it make a difference whether you're in the trial of the case and there is a jury that you have to consider whether the information is outside their knowledge? Does it matter if it's missing the statute of limitations for filing a lawsuit? Do you have to have expert testimony for that? Are there some kinds of malpractice that are so obvious on their face that they don't require expert testimony, or does everything require expert testimony?
The one area I know that the courts have recognized that you don't need expert testimony to establish the breach of the standard of care when somebody misses a plaintiff's attorney misses the statute of limitations, and that is probably a good example of that. Although I think in that instance you still could have an issue where you would need expert testimony on causation, because just because you missed the standard of care doesn't mean, or just because you missed the statute of limitation doesn't mean your client would have been able to recover anything from the defendant. You would still have to prove that you would have been able to prove your case, overcome any legal defenses, and what the damages would be. So I think limitations.
We're talking summary judgment here. Are you get poured out in summary judgment if you don't have an expert affidavit, if the claim is they missed the statute of limitations?
The Alexander case was poured out at the summary judgment level. It wasn't a limitations case, but the Supreme Court determined that the causation issue was not sufficiently obvious that you could do away with the expert testimony requirement and affirmed the summary judgment in that instance. And
I have a question. So in your mind, what would the expert testimony look like here? That's what I'm having a hard time with. Mr. Wilson shouldn't have told the plaintiff that? The plaintiff shouldn't have relied on that? I mean,
I think the expert testimony would have to address the issue of whether it was proper or not to claim in a sworn court filing that property that was actually held in your own name, in one of the plaintiff's own name, was really the estate's property. So you would have to have some testimony from an expert witness familiar with probate law and talking about those issues. And then I think the other thing you would have to have expert testimony about is, okay, what was the cause of damages here? Because, you know, we have a dispute. They're going to say, well, the cause of damages is that that we listed, based on your advice, we listed this property as being a state property. And I think Mr. Cowart said, well, if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been sued. And you know, I suppose it's possible that Garrett Gallagher never would have found out about the property and not sued because he never found out about it. But assuming that he did find out, I would think there was a very good chance he still would have sued and said, look, you had a state property that you hid from me, and this was really the estate's property. It was held in my mother's name, and you breached your fiduciary duty by not including that information in the court filing. And so testimony is going to be needed from an expert to testify whether that it was proper to do that or not, and then whether that is the cause of it, of damages. Now, they want to draw the line on the issue and read Alexander very narrowly and say it only applies to trial malpractice. If you read Alexander carefully, though, that's not what it says. It says it talks about errors in the preparation and trial of a case. And the court's holding was that the errors in that case, the causal link between those errors in the preparation and trial of a case was not sufficiently obvious that they caused the adverse result that you didn't need expert testimony. And the court also talked about tactical choices that are made during litigation.
Trial strategy. What trial strategy could there be for not having a correct inventory of the property of the estate?
Well, again, that's a disputed issue about whether it was correct to list that piece of property, the Trinity Vista Trail property, as a state property or not. Our position is that it had to be listed as a state property because it was held in the name of Mrs. Gallagher when she died. Their position is apparently no, that was really their property, and even though it was listed in her name, it shouldn't have been disclosed as a state property, and that's a dispute there, and that again gets into the issue of what is proper under the probate code, and it also then gives rise to the second issue, which is on causation, whether that was the cause of any damages, or whether it was the fact that Mr. Gallagher had estate property that he transferred to himself without any notice to his brother and without compensating his brother for his half interest in that property.
You said that whether it's estate property is the question. I mean, that's disputed. Isn't that what you just said?
It is a disputed issue, and it's going to require expert testimony on those matters.
Or a trial.
Excuse me?
Or a trial.
But in order to prove their case under Texas law, they're going to have to have expert testimony. So the other thing that I want to talk about, and it's important on Alexander, is, again, back to this issue of them trying to limit its holding to trial malpractice. That's not what the opinion says if you read it. It says errors in the preparation and the trial of the case. In that instance, that's not going to be sufficiently obvious that you can do away with the expert testimony requirement. They want to limit it and say, no, that just means trial malpractice. But again, you come back to the issue of there are all sorts of tactical issues that occur in the context of litigation before trial, during trial, and after trial that are tactical choices that are not going to be within the common understanding of jurors. And one example I would give the court, this case is an example. In this case, they asserted both a legal malpractice claim and, as plaintiffs often do in these cases, they asserted a breach of fiduciary duty claim to get around the statute of limitations. In our opinion, that's the reason they did it. And those are the kind of decisions that trial lawyers make every day that involve legal judgment. And Mr. Cowart said if it's a matter of, if it's not a matter of judgment, no expert testimony is necessary. Well, judgment is applied by lawyers every day. You know, at the start of the case, the trial of the case, after the case, as an appellate lawyer, I know I look into, all the time I'm faced with issues after a trial, adverse verdict against my client. The question comes up, what sort of post-trial motions are you going to file? And, one of the things you always think about is, do we file a motion for a new trial? And if we ask for a new trial, we better be careful, that we might get one. And if we get a new trial, what happens if it gets worse for us the second time around? And are we better off pursuing legal arguments, no evidence points, and going for a complete victory that way? That didn't happen in a trial, but that's a question of judgment. And those kind of issues are issues on which expert testimony is going to be necessary. And I do want to talk a little bit about why I think the issues here are not within the common understanding of jurors. The basic complaint here is that Mr. Wilson allegedly obtained an unfavorable settlement for the Gallaghers in the underlying lawsuit. And if the court looks at the Court of Appeals decision in the Burrow versus Arce case, and this is a decision that was cited with apparent favor by the Texas Supreme Court in the Alexander case. And in Burrow versus Arce, the Court of Appeals said that settling cases involves specialized skill and knowledge, and a lay jury cannot be expected to ascertain, without guidance from a legal expert, whether an attorney obtained a reasonable settlement for his or her client.
But and isn't that just one aspect of their claim damages? I mean, they're not... maybe I'm wrong, but I'm reading the briefs to say that their claim to malpractice is in Mr. Wilson's allegedly advising Patrick Gallagher, to sign the inventory of an appraisement and then to sign the documents closing, not necessarily in the settlement. I think that, unless I'm wrong, I'm assuming that the malpractice is allegedly arose there and the settlement is just one of their elements of damages.
Well, they're alleging that there were a number of acts that were negligent. That's their allegation, and that was one of them. But
so you're ultimately saying that they pleaded negligence in connection with legal malpractice in connection with the settlement.
They claim a number of acts of malpractice that all ultimately resulted in the damage, and their claimed damage here is that we entered into a settlement agreement that was less favorable than it would have been had you not done what you did. And I think that brings us, in other words, that's the key element of damages. I think they also have a...
So you're saying that they require expert testimony on the damages element?
Causation of those damages, that our acts caused those damages as opposed to what Mr. Gallagher did without my client's knowledge, which was to transfer this property from the estate to himself and his wife without the knowledge of his brother. And so that is the main element of damage, is the settlement. And if you look at the Burrow versus Arce case, the court is very clear that if you're talking about the reasonableness of the settlement and claiming that the attorney should have done a better job, got me a better settlement, you're going to have expert testimony on that. One of the other things I complain about here is that, and this is another allegation that they make, that Mr. Wilson missed the request for admission deadline. But again, this also ties into the claim damage from that is that we wound up settling the case for less favorable terms than we otherwise would have. But it is not obvious that, and it's not going to be obvious to jurors, that when you miss a request for admission deadline, you get something called deemed admissions. But in this case, then there was a motion to undeem those admissions that was granted. And That is not something a jury can just figure out on its own without some guidance from expert testimony. Final point I want to make here is in the Delp and the Strieber cases that were cited, that are relied on by the plaintiff, or by the Gallaghers, in both of those cases, although there was no expert testimony on causation, there was at least expert testimony on breach of the standard of care. And that we don't have that in this case. I see that my time is up. I'll be happy to answer any more questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Is your rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. on the question of the breach and whether there's expert testimony about how to list that or required on how to list the property, I think that that's a pure matter of law that's decided by the court on the basis of probate code section 250, which says if any property is owned in common with others, the interest owned by the estate shall be shown together with the names and relationship, if known, of co-owners. And it's the black and white letter of the law that we're talking about here. It's not a judgment call. It's not something that says you do it sometimes, you don't do it other times, and especially when it's hurts your client not to do it. On the question of why they were sued, that's not an expert testimony issue. That's a pure fact issue. What was the motivation for why they were sued? My client says, he believes his brother sued him primarily based off of the sworn documents, the inventory documents. That's what the evidence says. And as well, speaking of the sworn inventory documents and the sworn documents in the record, if you look at tab 3 of my brief's appendix, which has got the closing affidavit in there, and unfortunately for me, I neglected to write this citation down, but the probate code requires a closing affidavit in processing an estate. And on page 2, top of page 2 of that document, there's a line 3, the debts, if any, still owing by the estate, and written in there is none. Now, on page 1, he lists the full value of the Trinity Vista house, value of $99,000, whereas the testimony in the case says there was a $96,000 mortgage outstanding. So again, it's not a matter of, is it a judgment call to not list information correctly on these documents that are required by the probate code? And the probate code says these documents are required. A lawyer should be advising their client to list the information or to swear to accurate information on these documents, and Mr. Wilson did. And so, to my mind, to come in and say that an expert's going to come in and tell the jury, what's he going to do? Is he going to read the probate code to the jury? Is that what's required of an expert witness in this case?
Mr. Tower, was the mortgage on the house that you said had a balance of $96,000, was that in the name of Neva or Gallagher?
I don't know. That is not in the record, Your Honor, whether the mortgage itself. Now, Mr. Gallagher says, I made all the payments, and I think I would have to look directly at the affidavit that's also attached to my brief, Your Honor, in the next tab. But I thought he said, I made all the payments.
He did say that, but he didn't say in whose name the mortgage was placed. The title on the deed was in his mother's name in order to accomplish hospice matters.
Right, and I believe that's all the testimony in the record about.
So we don't know if the mortgage was in her name or not.
I think that's a correct statement, Your Honor.
If the mortgage was not in her name and it was in his name, then we got a problem with swearing to a mortgage.
I don't know, Judge. You mean in terms of him putting the mortgage debt as part of the estate property or the?
I don't know how a title company would ever have given the lien to anybody for making a loan on property that was in the name of Neva if the mortgage was signed by Patrick.
And he was on there. I would assume he was on there, Judge, but it's an assumption. I would assume based on his testimony that he made all the payments that it's actually in his name. In terms of the application of Alexander here, I think Alexander is clear when it talks about the kind of cases that it's contemplating that it's going to require expert testimony for. It says when there's these kind of tactical choices, what kind of tactical choices? The sentence before. Tactical choices that require judgment. So if you've got a situation where judgment is required in a presentation of litigation, you're going to have somebody come in and explain to the jury why that judgment call was wrong. But when you've got a situation like we've got here, where it's the plain letter of the law, you're not required to bring an expert in to talk about it. You know, Your Honors, other than those comments, I think that this case is adequately addressed in our brief, including my reply brief that I filed after the appellee's brief. So unless there's any further questions, I'll surrender the 30 seconds.
Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate y'all coming to argue. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted, and you are excused to go about your business if you'd like, or stay in.